Hello everyone, this is Barathatan the Science Man. This week's podcast will start off with my segment first, just to give a little spice and flavor. And then we'll jump straight into Court of Opinion with Baratha the Hutt. The main reason why we're doing my segment first is that we're going to look at COVID-19, as everyone's tired of hearing, but specifically looking at some of these medicines that are out there currently. So, without further ado, intro music, please. Awesome. Thank you. Now, let's start off by talking about a COVID-19 vaccine. I'm sure that there are many people who are anxiously awaiting some sort of vaccine for the COVID-19 strain. Specifically, it came out of SARS-CoV-2. There's some sort of, I wouldn't say debate, but a lot of scientists and epidemiologists are reasonably certain that there are two specific strains of COVID-19, of coronavirus, one affecting the East Coast and one affecting the West Coast, and those strains coming from Italy and China, respectively. Again, this is all hard to officially determine because of the lack of tracing and tracking of people and movements when this virus began. And what I'm talking about is a global scale, not individual nations. So definitely I've heard that Taiwan has done a good job in tracking people who have tested positive. I definitely know that Singapore as well has been really good at tracking. Of course, in the United States of America, it'll be very hard for tracking to be a nationwide effort. Let's go back to the vaccine again. So we have potentially two very specific strains of the virus, which means that you need to develop two vaccines. The vaccine process, even though I personally hope that it will be a matter of months, realistically it'll be a matter of potentially years. One, because coronavirus, or specifically SARS-CoV, there is no vaccine at all for any strains in the past. And there have been research in the past on trying to develop any sort of vaccine that would at least tackle one or two strains. Until recently, those efforts were more or less delayed because of lack of federal funding, from the government. So, quickly, just to, let me open up the CDC website. From a federal standpoint, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, monitor, test, and develop new vaccines, of course, with the help of pharmaceutical companies. Well, of course, mainly led by these pharmaceutical companies. So on the CDC website, when you're looking at vaccine testing and approval process, and you could definitely look it up yourself, cdc.gov/vaccines/basics/test-approve. The stages of the development cycle of vaccine goes like this: the exploratory stage, the preclinical stage, clinical development, regulatory review and approval, manufacturing, and quality control. So looking at this, the clinical development is a three-phase process where there are small groups of people receiving this trial vaccine. This is the vaccine that they're trying to develop and test. Phase 2, the clinical study is expanded and a vaccine is given to people who have certain characteristics that are similar to those for whom this new vaccine would be for. So, phase 2, if you intend to have the vaccine work for 95% of the public in America, then you'd look at people, say, for example, between the ages of 5 and 75 versus infants all the way up to people who are over 100 years old. In phase 3, vaccine is given to thousands of people and tested for efficacy and safety. So, just from a clinical standpoint and clinical trial standpoint, it takes a lot of time. Go into the FDA website, and you can look up CBER. So, the FDA, they have an organization called the Center for Biologics and Evaluation and Research, and they are responsible for regulating vaccines. So, after the vaccines have finished going through the process that the CDC website outlined, the FDA would come in and make sure that the vaccines are well regulated from a production standpoint, as well as making sure that people don't get negative reactions from them. And the FDA has a lot of information on specifically what the CBER does. And it mainly deals with a quality control standpoint from an industrial standpoint. So this can bore you a little bit, but that's just me trying to explain. It will be a long while before a vaccine is available for us, for the general public, for us to utilize and more or less eradicate the virus. And this is, of course, assuming that the vaccine is taken by a majority of Americans and that herd immunity would take over for the potentially between 0 and 5% that choose not to use the vaccine. Something else, of course, that has been on the news media for the past 5 months, almost half a year, is the use of hydroxychloroquine to treat those with COVID-19. Hydroxychloroquine is mainly used as a treatment for, or a preventative treatment, for people going overseas for malaria. And I believe it might be used in some other things, but that's the biggest thing, is that it's being used for preventative treatments and treatments for malaria. But a lot of hospitals and even the VA, even Veterans Affairs, have been allowing people to use hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19 treatments. Now, of course, there are a lot of anecdotal stories out there of people recovering from COVID-19 by taking hydroxychloroquine. What comes in is this idea of fact-based evidence versus an unmonitored clinical use, is how I'd say. And hydroxychloroquine, until the end of last week, was definitely in the unmonitored real clinical trial, clinical analysis, where people have been taking them, and there have been a lot of people telling their stories about it working. So this is something in which I'd like to bring back to what I talked about the vaccine earlier, where even not just vaccines, but of course all types of medicines and all types of medical treatments have to go through this process of validation, revalidation, testing, studies, and clinical trials. And I'm very happy that hydroxychloroquine is now being used, or is now being studied through the FDA and the CDC officially for COVID-19. Another medicine that they've been looking at is something called Remdesivir. That sounds like a Nordic name. Remdesivir. This medication, this antibiotic or antiviral medication, has been studied for the last couple of months, and I think they are concluding clinical trials within the next month. And another medication called azithromycin, also some sort of antivirals, also being is under study now too by the federal government. So I'm pointing this out just so that I just want to lay this out for everyone that scientists, epidemiologists, engineers, we all go through something called the scientific process by utilizing hypotheses and understanding data, and we go through a whole scientific process to make sure that we can validate without reasonable doubt that these treatments will or will not work. And that's why you hear a lot of doctors and scientists and pharmacists take caution within these last 5 months when talking about hydroxychloroquine. I should probably give it a nickname or something because it's pretty hard to say. Because it has not been through a formal process, formal scientific process, to see if it does treat COVID-19. And there was caution there because people were taking hydroxychloroquine for malaria and some other things as well, the way that it was originally intended for. By the news media talking about hydroxychloroquine in this very positive way, and even though it is good that they are providing at least, you know, anecdotal evidence that it's working, it unfortunately increased the prices of hydroxychloroquine very high for people who need it for what they needed it for the original intent. So by the FDA and the CDC taking the step and officially doing studies on hydroxychloroquine for treating COVID-19, that's a really good step. As well as these other two medicines, which I will not repeat anymore. So that's just something in which I want to keep in mind, is that we need to go through a formal scientific process to understand everything about these medications when trying to treat someone with COVID-19. Because a person with COVID-19 versus someone who does not have COVID-19, the medications might react differently. Because, you know, of course our bodies internally act differently. Let me not get too deep in that. Something that I do want to just leave open-ended is, why did it take the CDC and the FDA so long for them to start a formal investigative process on hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19? That's just something that can be open-ended. I'm not trying to spread any conspiracy theories here, even though there are a lot of people who would prefer that. All I'm saying is, here are the facts that are given to us, and it is up to you to help discern what this all means. Let's see here. So yes, this is something in which citizens of the United States needs to take a more proactive step in being citizens and being involved in the government, in the sense of talking to your representatives, talking to your senators, and trying to understand, hey, why isn't the government determining hydroxychloroquine as a reasonable medication to research for COVID-19? And that branches out into why do they select certain drugs over other drugs to test? Just a thought. Now, let's hand this off to Baratha the Hutt for his court of opinion section. Hi everyone, Baratha the Hutt here. Sorry, we'll not be analyzing any news articles this week, mainly because I think it's very pertinent to talk about how certain people in America are reacting to the stay-at-home orders, specifically those that have been reacting very negatively to the point of armed protests in our country for it. And this is not me saying that their actions are absolutely correct, nor am I saying that they're absolutely wrong. Talking in absolutes in this case will complicate things very much so. And in this court of opinion, I'd like to specifically see them as my brothers and sisters who, in one way or another, feel as though that their rights are being infringed upon and that the only way that they can react is to, unfortunately, protest with arms. In order to look at this, I think, or at least I'd like to go back to the early aughts when the government passed the Patriot Act, oh my goodness, I can't even say it, where surveillance on regular citizens became the norm. Surveillance where warrants aren't needed, unmonitored monitoring of citizens has become a very, very big deal, since 9/11. And we see that there are small bills passed since then, which, quote-unquote, took away our individual rights. Now, of course, all of these bills which increased unregulated surveillance, those things were spoken about in terms of keeping us safe. You know, there is a limit to invading someone's privacy for the sake of trying to keep the country safe. And something that I looked at earlier, if I could pull it up again, from the ACLU, which is pretty, they're showing pretty old data here. Let's see where these dates are. It looks like they're focusing on the Patriot Act in its early years, between 2003 and 2005. Let's see here. So, Patriot Act passes. It allows something called NSLs, which are national security letters. They are issued to FBI agents without a judge's approval, without a warrant, to obtain personal information of individuals, specifically phone records, computer records, credit history, banking history, etc., etc. Looking at these, between 2003 and 2005, 143,074 NSLs were granted, of which 55 were reported criminal, 17 were for money laundering, 17 related to immigration, 19 involving fraud, and 0 were terrorism. So seeing here, 53 versus 143,000 is pretty concerning, where a lot of people had their right to privacy violated for one thing or another, for some sort of suspicion, maybe even say without even good probable cause to be monitored. Now, I'm mentioning all of this right now to say that certain groups of people, certain news media have been paying attention to this and more or less either reported it as it is or blew it out of proportions, trying to bring their viewers into the fold of this sense of fear of us losing our rights, our individual rights, our right to privacy, to stir something up. And it's most apparent now because of these stay-at-home orders, where these people who have become wary of the federal government for quote-unquote spying on them, they say, all right, stay-at-home orders, the last straw. I'm not going to sit idly by when my rights are being taken from me so visibly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to round up 200 people and go up to a state capitol with guns a-blazing. Well, with guns, but not a-blazing. And signs, not wearing masks, and let me start protesting. Because we don't want to stay at home. You're forcing us to do things against our will, against our individual rights to the pursuit of happiness, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's how I see it. Where the government's responsibility to protect the people ended up becoming what looks like an overstepping of certain rights that we have. And then, of course, that gets blown out of proportions with certain news media who are biased towards one side or the other. And then you continue feeding that and feeding that and feeding that for years. A growing sense of not trusting the federal government. And then you have something like COVID-19 that's the final straw that broke the camel's back. So that's how I've been viewing my fellow citizens, my sisters and brothers who are protesting. I personally disagree with that because of the health risk that they've caused on themselves and others, as well as instilling fear in those that didn't want to protest, that were agreeing towards a stay-at-home order. Showing up with guns is a pretty good way to instill fear into people. So, all of this to say, I've been trying to kind of do a quick plotting out of how we got to this point of protests during a pandemic and trying to understand where those people come from. I just feel really bad because, you know, they've endangered themselves and many other people by protesting so openly throughout the entire country. But this sense of government overstepping the rights of people, that's always been going on. You're talking about the rights of Native Americans throughout the history of the United States. You're talking about slavery, you're talking about voting rights, you're talking about inequality that women face today as well as the past. So yeah, federal government is not the best. And you have certain leaders at the helm who don't make things better, whether it be this current administration or the previous administration and administrations before that. Even though humanity has been progressing towards justice, it has been pretty slow and a lot slower than what people want. And because of that frustration, certain groups of people in power take advantage of it. And in this time of, the COVID-19 pandemic, there needs to be a sense of unity, no sense of partisanship, so that we can get through this together. And that's not really happening. That's kind of sad. To kind of do a slight tangent, I had a phone call with my godmother the other day, which was really needed for me and my spiritual life. We were talking about suffering, and then my godmother said this: "Christ became human to show us the bondage we force on each other, that even God has experienced injustice to wake us up to it." Christ became human to show us the bondage we force on each other, that even God has experienced injustice to wake us up to it. Pretty powerful stuff. Definitely, you can interpret it as you will. There are definitely things in my personal life in which I kind of think about all the time in a pretty negative way, which causes my own bondage, but also the way that I act towards others. Sometimes not the best. Catch me on a pretty bad, terrible day. I might, unfortunately, react in a pretty crappy manner. And that in of itself is a sense of bondage, especially if I say something very mean to someone. And of course, it's grows into bondage grows into something as big as the systemic issues of racism and sexism and inequality. So yeah, a very awesome quote, Godma. Thank you for that. Just something in which I am frustrated because I dislike the actions of the protesters. I think I understand where they're coming from. I'm kind of stuck right there. Of course, hopefully hopefully you've been open enough to listen to me talk about it, and I definitely hope that you all think about the people, quote unquote, on the other side, to try to understand where they're coming from. And it's a very hard thing. The oppressed trying to understand where the oppressor is coming from, the oppressor trying to understand where the oppressed are coming from. It's a very difficult way to think about people, to think about inequality. But I think that's where Jesus wants us to be. To be uncomfortable with that. To try and understand one another. That there is justice involved. But this justice requires love and mercy. So that we all can better love one another as sisters and brothers. That's all there is to it. So yeah, thank you guys for listening to this week's podcast, for listening to this court of opinion. I definitely hope that you all see hope in all things. Until next time.